It's Ouch Talk Show for November. We do what's loosely described as disability talk. But thanks for tuning in anyway. I'm Simon Minty.
And I'm Kate Monaghan. And we'll introduce our guest shortly. But first of all, so much more importantly, as I hear you've been to Dubai, Simon.
I did, I went.
You really get around the place, don't you?
Thank you, yeah. My cousin got married. He lives there. He got married to his British wife there as well.
Yeah.
Very bling, very full on.
Is it?
I think we had 5 days of celebration. It was exhausting. I'm not very well, cough and fever and everything.
Oh, poor old you.
How are you? How's Scout?
Yeah, Scout's great, thank you.
I should have just asked, how are you though?
Yeah.
Because you are an independent person.
I am an independent person. And to celebrate that, actually, Holly and I had our first date night last week.
Oh, what, without baby
without
mother?
The baby, yeah, which was very exciting.
Who babysat, though? Family?
Yeah, so Holly's mum.
Very well trusting. Didn't put them just in the creche or something?
Yeah, we just left her, actually, with the cats. Got 4 cats, they can look after her. There's always someone around.
Michael Gove did it with his 11-year-old child
exactly.
And 2 dogs in the hotel.
Yeah. If he can do it,
yeah,
I can.
Come on, relax. Why are we all worried about this thing?
Yeah. And what was Dubai like for disability, then?
It's a bit difficult. I'm not going to pretend that.
Really?
I first went there about 10 years ago, and I've been 2 or 3 times since for various reasons. It
You'd
is
think
better.
With all that money that they'd have everything perfect.
No, it's different. They're doing what we do. They don't think about it. And I tell them, and I say, look, you've got a chance to get this perfect from the start.
Yeah.
And they go, don't worry. We'll just get it all up. Let's get the buildings up. Then we'll go and have a look at it again.
Really?
And you're like, no, but you could do it properly, but you can't. However, there's this stretch called Jumeirah Beach Road, which is the kind of main touristy thoroughfare now, and that had drop curbs everywhere. It's the first time I went where I didn't feel stranded in my hotel. I could go out and have a look at my mobility scooter.
Mm.
I was the only person. I did bump into one other British disabled person. They had an umbrella because it was so hot, like a little parasol,
yeah.
Which I thought was a great idea. And they'd had a torrid time going to Thailand and Aichi Bai. So travel's still difficult.
But you didn't see any sort of native people in Dubai with disabilities?
Nope.
Wow.
10 years ago, I went and I stayed in the hotel and I asked when I was leaving, I said, could I see your accessible room just to see what it's like? And they showed me and I said, it's all the same except the balcony's just been blocked off. And I think that was because they thought if you're disabled, they don't want us to throw ourselves off. And that was their concession to disability.
I mean, it's an important concession. So, you know, thank goodness they've got that, because otherwise you get to Dubai and you think, well, what's the point? Over I go.
It's so hot here.
Yeah.
The expats I met, it is so geared for tourism. They're realising they've got to get it right. And so that's why it's becoming accessible. Not legislation, it's because the visitors who are coming are demanding something.
So is that the purple pound working its way
in? I guess.
Purple pound being the disabled pound, because we've somehow commandeered the colour purple.
Yeah.
But so people are sort of thinking, actually disabled people equals a little bit more money?
That is part of it. Don't forget there's also the sort of Western influence. There were people, there's places like Shake Shack, the burger chain, IHOP. There's a whole load of Western hotels. They do that by default, and that starts spreading.
Right.
The irony was the drop curbs were fine. Outside my hotel, they had made a little ramp. It was a 45-degree. There's just no way you could use it.
No, wow.
So they kept telling me, use that. And I said, no, the drop curb is the natural, that's the better one. So I was pleased and surprised I could go out and do things on my own for the first time.
And did you choose a hotel based on accessibility because you knew it was going to be difficult?
No, of course. I went with my family, particularly my sister, and it was only after she'd booked it all. I said, did you check accessibility? She went, oh, no, I didn't think of that. She said, it's near the beach, though. You know, that's what family do. This might come up a bit later on, isn't it? They tend to forget your needs as long as they've got a good deal in a nice hotel.
I'd like to say that's not true in my family, but sometimes it is.
That's kind of sometimes what families have to do. They sort of forget that and you have to remind. I shared.
But in a way, that's quite nice because they don't, they just, you know, it's like they see you as just part of the family.
And as long as I stay in my room because I can't go anywhere. No,
yeah, because they wouldn't want to socialise with you. So that's their way of just telling you that.
I shared a room with my 20-year-old nephew, who is nearly 20, and my sister. There's 3 of us.
You shared a room with them?
A tiny room.
Were you too tight to get your own?
There's lots of complications and changes of people coming and going and so on. So it just ended up like that. The bit that made me laugh was in the second night, whatever, we had a WhatsApp group for all of us. And the 3 of us were texting each other, laying on beds next to each other. I said, well, why can we not talk?
Oh, you're so old, Simon.
I knew you were going to say that.
That's how the youth today,
that's how we all
communicate. You wouldn't understand it.
Even you would have done the same. I know it's an old fogey thing to say, but nevertheless, the 3 of us laying next to each other texting.
All right, well, as interesting as your holiday is, we have got a show to do, yes, and it's not all about you, I'm afraid.
Well, should we say hello to our guests?
Yeah, I think let's say hello to the guests then.
In our Salford studio, it's Heather Lacey. Hello.
Hello.
And you're here to do our social media roundup a little bit later.
Yeah.
People might know you as the person behind the No Superhero blog. What do you blog about?
So the main thrust of my blog really is for disability and mental health, but it's kind of expanded into a bit of lifestyle as well, so there's a good mix there. But yeah, it's really fun to do. I love my social media, so it's a nice way to get things done.
You're the perfect person to be doing our social media roundup, really.
Hopefully, yeah.
But in the meantime, we've got a bit of a first, and I'm not going to say it's a first in a good way. You know, some people are like, we've got a first, it's a world-exclusive play of Coldplay's new single. No, not for us. In a first, our producer was a bit lazy this weekend. I think he had a party to go to or something. So we don't have enough stuff to fill the show.
No music. Either.
There's no music, there's no guest.
We have guests.
We've got two guests. We normally have three. We've only got the one. So instead, he's now on sort of like he and the Ouch team are on a Challenge Annika style mission. They have been tasked with coming up with an item for the end of the show. No idea what it's going to be. But I mean, it's quite exciting.
Damon, our editor, was on Challenge Annika as a kid.
Are you kidding me?
He just told me.
That's incredible. Okay, apparently that's a story for another day.
Long, long way away.
But yeah, so hopefully we'll have something coming up at the end of the show, but, you know, who knows what it's going to be.
If necessary, we'll talk about Dubai again.
Exactly. Let's talk about more about your blinging holiday, shall we?
So we're going to begin by talking to a guest who we've got in the studio in front of us. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
So it's Laura Smith. We did an item about disabled siblings about this time last year.
We did, just before Christmas, wasn't it?
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And we thought it's something that we should return to. We found you by an organisation called SIBS, that's S-I-B-S, and the name probably explains itself. It's an organisation for siblings of disabled people. You're a supporter and a former trustee. SIBS say there's over 500,000 young siblings and at least 1.7 million adult siblings in the UK who've grown up with a disabled brother or sister. We're going to come back to them a little bit later on, no doubt, but I want to get into your story. We don't often hear these stories, and I think listeners might be surprised, they might be enlightened. So let's start at the beginning. You're 33, you've got a disabled sister who's 31. Tell us a bit about her.
So Katie is severely autistic, so she's nonverbal. She has some behavioural challenges, and she's also epileptic. But over the years, her epilepsy has got worse and worse, which is causing some medical challenges for her. She uses PEC symbols to communicate, and she also So it's basically just symbols that have words on them and a picture, mm-hmm. so that if she wants a drink or if she wants an orange squash or something, she can use those symbols to express herself. She does a little bit of Makatom to explain herself, but she kind of puts her own twist on it. So not everybody would recognise it as official Makatom. Mm. But growing up with her over the years, obviously myself and my family and our friends, we know what she's trying to communicate most of the time. She doesn't have any physical disability, so she does have mobility, but like a lot of people like Katie, she is very overweight. She's on a lot of medication, including steroids, which can really sort of, you know, have an implication on her weight. So
now I guess before we go much further with this, you had to have a conversation before you came on the programme today because you wanted to make sure that it was all okay with your parents to be discussing this. Have you talked to your parents about your feelings about growing up with Katie and the things we're going to be talking about today? Have you had that conversation before, and how did it go saying I'm going to go on a BBC talk show and talk about it?
Yeah, I think for a lot of siblings, talking publicly about your experience of growing up with someone like Katie can be very challenging, and it's quite personal, naturally. I think also because you're talking about your disabled sibling, but you're also talking about your family life, I think consent for siblings can be a bit of a challenge. So I was really upfront with my parents and said, you know, this opportunity has come up. I'd like to go on and talk about it. Are you both comfortable with that? And they said, yes, we are. But the fact that I have to go through those steps, I think, highlights why it is quite challenging for siblings to come out publicly and talk about some of their experiences.
You wrote a blog a year or two ago, and we've asked you, we found you. This wasn't you saying, I want to come and talk. This was us asking
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's right. Because
we thought it was really interesting, and that maybe we need to ask for permission. And that is there any sort of no-go boundaries, or can we ask you whatever we want to ask? Or if we ask you something a bit, you can just go, no, I'm not going to answer it.
No, there's no-go boundaries. Fine. I'm a pretty sort of open person anyway and pretty honest. And I think it's nice to have the opportunity to come and talk about these things. You kind of yourself don't know how interesting or helpful it would be, but if it is helpful for other siblings, then it's something that I'm really happy to talk about.
So what was it like growing up with Katie then? What did you find as some of the good points but also the challenges of growing up with her?
Well, I think for me, growing up with Katie has been amazing, and it sounds really cheesy, but she's completely shaped me as a person. And I think a lot of the qualities that I have as a person, so really enjoying getting to know people, being talkative and being patient and tolerant and not judging people in any way, shape or form when I meet them, is as a direct result of growing up with Katie. So there are huge amounts of positives. And you were talking earlier about a normal, typical sibling relationship. You know, Katie and I have got that. She might not speak and she might have learning disabilities, but we still fight over who gets, you know, the rest of the roast potatoes on a Sunday lunch, or who gets the front seat in the car, you know, or who gets to sit somewhere in the lounge. We still have those normal sibling relationship. But I think growing up as a child, to start with, you don't know that anything's different. It's only when you start going to school or socialising with friends and you kind of go back to their house for tea and you kind of go, oh, okay, this setup's a bit different to my setup at home. So Katie and I have always been very close. We shared a bedroom. We used to go everywhere together.
You're living together now, or where is everybody?
So I actually live around the corner from Katie. So Katie lives in independent provision. Mm-hmm. And I've moved from London to be close to her. So she's literally a 5-minute walk away from me, because I do like to be close to her and to be able to see her as much as I can. But I guess the kind of tough things about growing up with Katie were people's reactions. I remember sort of if we'd go out into town and Kate might throw a wobbly and she might have been really upset about something or making noises or rocking. It was having to manage people's reactions from a really young age, which was really difficult when you're growing up in those, you know, formative years. And I found myself just kind of going up to people and going, oh, she's autistic, that means this, and, you know, maybe next time you won't say that to somebody. And I just kind of, I guess, a little campaigner kind of started right from those early years, because I was so fiercely protective of my sister.
And you were sort of talking then about going to other people's home, you know, your friends' houses for tea and stuff like that. How did that differ? What did you see as different?
It was a lot calmer. So obviously every family has their ups and downs. They have their challenges, their good moments, their bad moments. But, you know, for me, having dinner was challenging with Katie. She might not sit at the table. She might have thrown her food around. She might have eaten really quickly. She might have had a wobbly and everybody had to leave the table. So I might have been sat there on my own eating. And it was chaotic in some ways. It felt completely normal for it to be quite chaotic, but I think when I went to other people's, I noticed they had more time to sit and talk. And
this was something, and my quick apology, I may cough occasionally, I'm trying to keep it away from the mic, but that was something that struck me, that part of sitting around a table as a family and talking. And we know we don't do it like you used to do it 30-40 years ago, but it still happens, and particularly maybe on a Sunday. And not to have that part just sounds very difficult.
Yeah, and I remember sort of trying to do my homework from home, and I remember it being normal that Katie would have drawn on it, or she might have ripped it, or Mum might say to me, you know that book, your art book, Katie's put it in her bag, but we can't take it out because she's going to headbutt us. And it's kind of like, OK, that's my schoolwork, you know, I've got to submit that tomorrow. So things about learning at times were quite hard, because if Katie had a bad night, I would have a bad night. So I would be going into school a bit sleep deprived. And I think some of this stuff is quite common for siblings, but it's not really talked about, or I don't think recognised in schools or in the early year settings.
So 3 days into the holiday I have with my family, my sister, we're waiting in the lift, and my sister said, oh, we're on the 17th floor. She said, oh, whenever I'm with you, I spend half my life waiting for lifts when I'm with you. And I said, well, take the stairs then. So there was that little bit. So this is a long way of me saying, you sound saintly. You sound remarkably saintly. Did you not ever kind of go, for crying out loud, what about me? Or this is my work, or this is my... I'm being almost disabled by my sister. You sound incredibly good.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, because I asked my mum exactly that question. I was like, but mum, didn't I throw my toys out the pram or have a wobbly, or didn't I say horrible things to you, or didn't I resent Katie when I was little? And she said, no. She said, the sad thing about it, Laura, is that you just completely accepted from the age of three that there was someone in your life who was always going to be more important and their needs were always going to need to come first. And she said, that makes me quite sad, really, that you didn't throw those wobblies. But actually, as I've got older, I think I found it harder. Mm. And I think a lot of siblings, maybe as they get older and start to process a bit more about how they grew up, or it might be some kind of trigger, like a relationship or a breakdown, that kind of makes you look back as well as forward.
How has it impacted your life now, do you think?
Well, it impacts a huge amount, really, because I'm choosing to live close to my sister so I can help out with her care.
But you work, I mean, you run your own business and so
I
on.
I do, yeah. Exactly. So the positives about that is I can maybe build that around my schedule rather than having to be somewhere at 8 and not being allowed to leave until 6. There might be a little bit more flexibility. I'm very involved in sort of Katie's care, so kind of engaging with social workers and her care team and the challenging behaviour unit that we have for Kate. So I take quite a hands-on approach, and I have to juggle that and have to fit that in with my business and my friends and any relationship I might be in. You know, there's lots that I have to make work, but for me as a sibling, I've chosen to be very involved, and not everybody might make that choice, but it's only me and Katie. There's no one else. So, you know, we don't have another brother or sister, so if I don't support, I kind of feel like there's no one else to pick up the reins, if that makes sense.
You don't have a mum or dad?
So my mum and my dad are involved. My mum and dad divorced when I was 18. And I think it's really common that families who have got a disabled person, like Katie with a learning disability or autism, do often divorce because it's very stressful. So I do have them, but my dad doesn't live close by. And my mum's under an incredible amount of physical and mental stress as a result of being a carer for 29 years.
There's some real depth in your bit about you being the one. I want to just bring in Heather for a moment. Heather, you've got a non-disabled twin, yeah. Brother?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is anything that Laura's saying echoing, or are you very different? Where are you at?
There's certain aspects of what you've said with regards to, you know, you were saying you're quite accepting of things. I remember it was fairly recently, actually, my brother kind of turned around to my mum and said he felt quite guilty, actually, that I was kind of affected by things that he wasn't affected by, because I have a lot of chronic pain with my condition.
I'm
both trying to jump in to find out what your disability is.
Yeah, so I have mild cerebral palsy, so hemiparesis. It was a bit like a stroke, I guess. And I also have a spinal condition as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think that impacts on your brother then?
Well, he's had to kind of deal with me going to a lot of hospital appointments and things like that. Particularly when I was diagnosed with the spinal condition, I was in a brace for a while and we were thinking about surgery and whatnot. He's always said, you know, I wish I could take the pain away. I wish I could kind of shoulder that burden for you. So I think for him, it's more that he doesn't know how to help me. He'd quite like to help me, but he feels a bit lost in a way. And what I would like is for him not to feel so bad about it, really. Yeah. You know, he has no control over what happens kind of to my body. As long as he's kind of supportive of me, that's all he can do. And I'm really grateful about that.
So, Laura, I mean, if Katie could speak to you, what do you think she'd be saying? Do you think she'd say, go out, have a life, get on with stuff? Or do you think she'd be saying, no, stay with me, look after me?
I think she probably would be saying, you know, get on with things, don't think about things too much, you know, enjoy your life. So I think I try and always remember that, because I don't want to live my life like some saint that's kind of, you know, moved my identity over to my sister's. But I think because obviously Katie's needs are so severe, I guess I do feel that responsibility, and I think a bit of guilt, because we obviously come from the same gene pool, and yet, you know, I'm very blessed to just be typical. You know, I'm not perfect, I've got my problems, I've got X, Y, and Z going on, but actually I can talk, I can express myself, and she can't. And I think for me, I've carried that for my life. I just want to make her life happier in any way that I can, really. And it gets harder for people as Katie as they age in the system and go into independent living provision or residential care, whatever it might be. It's really tough for them. So I guess if I can make her smile as much as I can in the week, I want to do that. It makes me happy.
You mentioned sort of relationship bit, and they've got to understand you may have to drop everything. It reminds you, have you seen the film Love Actually?
Yeah.
Okay. And what about maybe one day you want children? How do you feel about all the relationship, your sister, children?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because it's something that I'm kind of thinking about a lot at the moment. So I recently came out of a 7-year relationship, and I did find it quite hard because, you know, before they even put a ring on your finger, I kind of find myself thinking, well, can they handle a life with my sister? You know, what would happen if there was a crisis and my sister had to move into our home? What if we had kids and I was struggling to be a good mum because I was distracted by my relationship with Katie? And it kind of puts a lot of pressure on, like in the early stages of a relationship where you just want to be having fun. You're kind of thinking about stuff that you might not otherwise need to think about. And I mean, the having kids question is a really interesting one for me, because if you'd have asked me in my 20s, I would have said, oh, absolutely, I feel really maternal, I'd love to have children. But in my 30s, I guess I know a little bit more about my life with Katie and what that's going to look like in the future. I also, quite frankly, worry about having an autistic child myself, or a child of any kind of disability. And there's quite a lot of research coming out at the moment that's mentioning genetic factors, and that's kind of creating quite a feeling of sort of anxiety in me about whether that's something I could or should do. And yet I don't really have many people to talk to about that. So I guess that's why an organisation like SIBS that you mentioned earlier, Simon, is really important, because you can talk to peers and you can find a way to sort of say, look, I'm feeling this. Do you feel this as well?
And do you have help? Do you have somebody that you go and talk to on a regular basis?
Well, growing up, no, not really. But as an adult, I have chosen to speak to somebody once a week. So I've basically found a counsellor that kind of specialises in family and transition and things like that. And I just kind of decided that I needed to find a way to express some of these concerns.
Absolutely.
I didn't really want to sort of burden my mum or my dad with them. And, you know, maybe some of my friends, I didn't want to kind of go into too many details, but I found that really helpful. But the other thing that I've done is via SIBS, they've started developing support groups. So when I was living in London, I went to the one in London, which was really helpful every month. And I'm just about to go to one in Brighton. And I think that was a really good way to kind of talk to people that just got it. You know, you didn't have to over-explain yourself. They just got the things that you said because they were in exactly the same position as you.
And did you find any, I mean, I agree with you and I love it when you find that commonality. Did you have any tips or things that someone did differently you thought, I should do that?
I think the biggest thing that I find really helpful is when somebody said, you know, well, have you downloaded this guide? You know, this guide is really helpful in terms of thinking about the future. Well, have you read this article about genetics? That might help you think about this. And it's that kind of sharing of information and ideas and resources. But we actually do have a dearth of that. So for siblings in particular, there isn't much information out there. I mean, obviously there's a SIBS website and there's a couple of other areas. But really, for someone like me at my age, to find information, I have to really search for it. So if you find yourself in a crisis, so if my mum, you know, heaven forbid, drop down dead tomorrow, in a crisis, I would be having to get a huge amount of information about what the impact is going to be on my sibling and also on myself.
You were talking about the relationship that you were in. Do you think having an autistic sister led to the breakdown of that relationship?
I think probably not. I think there were some incompatibility things that probably ultimately did. But I think I got scared, if I'm honest. I think I kind of ran away from the relationship because I was worrying about the future. And because I hadn't really had any people to kind of talk to and work it through with, I think I just had to take myself away to get some space to kind of really process that. And I hope that, you know, if I find myself in a relationship again in the future, that I'll be a lot stronger about kind of expressing myself and saying, look, these are the things that I might need to think about in the future. Whereas I felt in that last relationship, it was just coming down on my head and I wasn't really able to process it very easily.
And do you think it was almost, you don't want to burden somebody else with, and forgive my language, but it's almost something that you feel you've got to carry and you didn't want someone else to have this as well?
100%. And I think that was what made the breakup so hard, because I love this person very much, but I was worried about them having to have that life. And I mean, there are lots of positives.
It's awful to think that you know, that having a sister like Katie is contributing to the breakup of an incredibly important relationship in your life. Like, that's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Well, and also there's a sense of what I'm sensing from you is that word about duty. This is your sister, she's number one, I've got to be there, and I totally get that, I understand it. And when I was ill recently, my sister did help me a lot, so I'm flippant. What did your boyfriend say? Because if I was the boyfriend, I'd say, I'm okay with that. We have a good relationship, don't finish with me because of your sister. I can take that on.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm honest, I think that's what I struggle to talk about. So I think perhaps if I'd have processed things a little bit earlier, and I think perhaps if I mean, I think I was really struggling at the time because Katie had moved out of home. The transition was very difficult. We were in hospital a lot with her. Like, she was having fits and dislocating parts of her body. And I think we were in a process like of crisis. Mm. And I think I was just struggling to find the headspace to actually talk about that in the relationship. But I do think if we could get a bit better in terms of being preventative, so if we could start having siblings talking a lot younger and connecting with each other and being able to access information, perhaps adults wouldn't be reaching their 30s and 40s and having maybe, I don't know what to call it, a little mini midlife crisis about the Porsche. Mm. You know, perhaps that might be the way to go so that more siblings feel empowered.
What do you wish had been there for you when you were growing up?
I really wish that there'd been more understanding about what was going on at home, so that when I was learning, if I was having a bad day, if I hadn't had much sleep, my teachers had a little bit more understanding about what was going on. Same with doctors, actually. So if I was experiencing any sort of periods of concern or depression, there was somebody that was kind of like, okay, she's a sibling, therefore there's these things going on. I think I wish that I had consistently attended a sibling support group, so I had those friendships. I mean, obviously, I'm always going to have other friendships as well, but just to have that group of people that you can talk to, I think would have been really beneficial for me.
So when you go to SIBS now, do you occasionally come across a chap and think, oh, he's going to get it because he's got a sibling? Are they more compatible?
Are you saying, is SIBS basically a dating support charity?
Every cloud.
Do you know what? There is this part of you that kind of thinks that they would really get it.
Exactly,
but it's like what you guys said earlier, life's about so much more than that. And I have an identity that is, you know, like, I have things that are my problems that are completely not about having a disabled sister like Katie. So compatibility is compatibility, but you do need somebody to get it and to support you for the rest of your life. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to be an easy ride.
And not in a competitive way. You'd hate, hang on, my sister, I've got to go for my sister. And you go, no, mine's more important.
Yeah,
exactly.
I can't see you for 6 months because I'm so busy.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think every sibling is different. So the fact that I've chosen to be a bit more involved, I wouldn't judge a sibling that has chosen not to be as involved. I think it's a very, very personal choice.
And I also think you're it's clumsy, but the impairment stuff and the nature of it and the engine, your family, there's a ton of things that are all involved in that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Families are intrinsically complicated, wonderful, weird, brilliant.
Yep.
You know, that's family life without having somebody that has a disability. So, and there's huge amounts of positives over the years. I think for me, I just think I've realised that some of the things that I struggle with are things that I should have processed and dealt with a long time ago.
What I'm very happy about, though, is one, you come on the show, but two, that you do now have someone, and that the bit I love about counselling and all that stuff is you've got an hour a week, it's your time, no one's judging you, you can say what the hell you want, and it's that time to work it through. That sounds great. Really good.
That was absolutely fascinating, Laura. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
You're going to stick around.
You're going to stick around, obviously. But I'm just getting told in my ear that, again, challenge Annika Stiley. Yeah. We're having to throw the plans into the air because all of a sudden we've got somebody in our Edinburgh studio who wants to talk to us. So, Heather, can we just hold on? We were meant to come to you for social media news. We're now not going to.
Of course.
We will be back with you shortly. But apparently we've got Emma in the studio in Edinburgh. Emma.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, how is your helicopter?
Okay.
Challenge Annika. Challenge Annika. How's your bottom?
Sorry. My helicopter are fantastic. Yeah, I love helicopters.
Good. I mean, we've heard that you have been rummaging around in people's handbags. I mean, I don't really know what's going on. Is this allowed at the BBC?
I'd imagine if people know me well, they wouldn't be surprised that I've been rummaging around in people's bags. I'm pretty nosy.
This is very last minute, isn't it? So we don't know what's happening.
Yeah, so what's going on?
Well, last week I saw a tweet from Kate Ansell, who some of you might know. She's a TV producer, but she was saying that she was bringing a wooden spoon to work because she tagged it cerebral palsy problems. And it turned out she was bringing a wooden spoon to work with her because her boots were quite tight. And due to her cerebral palsy, she has an unusual gait and feet that end up at odd angles. So she was bringing the wooden spoon so that she could pop it down the back of her heel of her boot, between her heel and her foot, to give her more room to reposition the wayward foot in her boot.
Why couldn't she use a shoehorn?
Well, I don't really know, but I guess they're harder to come
by. Oh, sorry. Oh, a wooden spoon. Yeah. How fascinating.
They're harder to come by, I guess. And what happened, actually, as it turned out, she broke the spoon in the process of doing what she was doing. But it got me thinking. So I started to have a virtual nosy in people's bags. And I asked all over Facebook and Twitter, what's unusual things disabled people carry around with them for disability-related reasons? And I got quite a number of interesting ones. So I've also got someone else to help me, because obviously challenge Annika style, I've been bringing in favours all over the place this
excellent,
morning.
Excellent.
And I've got our favourite disabled occupational therapist on the line.
Our favourite one.
Elizabeth Hodge. She's been on Ouch before. She was on the Ouch News.
Yeah, she was
section.
Our correspondent for a
yes.
bit, wasn't she?
So say hi to Elizabeth.
Hey Elizabeth, how are you doing?
Hi everyone, I'm well, thank you.
Good to hear from you again.
Great. I just thought it'd be good to have an OT perspective on some of these. Now, I was going to do a little quiz with you guys.
Oh.
So I've got a list of things that disabled people have been carrying around with them on their person, keeping handy, just in case.
And what are we going to guess? The impairment? What are we guessing?
You've got to guess why they're carrying them.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to say the item, you say why they might have them.
Is it fingers on buzzers? How are we doing this?
Just shout. Shout. There's no prizes here, I'm afraid. It's all for fun. Okay? So the first one is a tennis ball.
A stress. Squeeze it for stress.
I'd say stress as well.
No, you've got stress balls for that.
What do you think, Kate?
I would say
draw a little face on it and make it a little puppet as fun, like a comfort
Wilson
toy. A comfort
in
toy.
The Tom Hanks film.
Yeah, and Dell and Tilly.
Yeah. No, I'd say something like roll your back or something so you can roll up and down the wall.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah.
That is actually pretty much true.
Yes!
Very good, Katie.
Yay,
tweets.
Well done, both of you.
Yes.
I'll give Heather part of that as well, because I think she was kind of on the way there.
You should see the smile Kate's got. She's so
grinning.
Chuffed.
Yep.
Well, Laura, you're playing as well, aren't you? Shout in.
Thinking, you know, throw it to somebody, you know, if you want to start a chat, throw the ball.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's one way to get their attention.
Oh, hit them on the head.
That's
wake
a good
them
one.
Up.
I would probably break a window if I did that. Yes, so my friend Mike, who wants to remain as anonymous as that, has one under his desk at work because it's his feet that are often the trouble. He's got muscle and skeletal pain and he carries one in his bag as well. And if his kids don't take them and play with them, they last for absolutely ages and they're very handy.
Excellent.
So that was a good one.
1-0 to Kate, just putting that out there.
Elizabeth, would you recommend to carry things like that around? Tennis balls?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, that tennis ball one is something I've personally used myself to relieve muscle pain, and it's really effective. So I think that's a great use. And I guess it's also handy, maybe if you have a guide dog. I don't know if you throw balls for those, but I guess there's other uses for a tennis ball. And I know that people sometimes can cut a hole in them and use them to make a switch or something larger if they can't grasp it. So, yeah, I think tennis balls are really versatile.
Wow. Oh, so they might use it, like attach it to a light switch or something and be able to pull it have something big to grab?
Potentially, or even like more of a joystick control, perhaps on a wheelchair or something like that. It makes the end of it much easier to grasp.
Okay, so the takeaway from this, I think, is that every disabled person should basically carry a tennis ball. Yeah,
well, absolutely. Now I'm off to the shops after this. Yeah.
Okay, next one, a bottle. Simon?
So obviously not, it could be the same to roll their foot on. So it's obviously not what it's meant to be used for, that's the point of it. So roll their foot on it.
Empty a catheter bag into it.
Put a little message in it and throw it across the office, communication.
Anything from the visiting guests?
Laura, Heather.
What was it again?
A bottle.
A bottle.
The only thing that I used a bottle for literally is to carry water, so I don't know.
Well, Kate, again, Kate wins again.
Yes!
Because not quite half a point, I'm going to say. Because it's not to empty a catheter in, it's to actually go straight into.
Oh, okay, fair dues. So, if you're a boy, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah,
I know.
Funnel as well.
Boys are lucky that way. And I didn't really think about. I hadn't thought about this. Obviously,
can
you guys
just,
hadn't.
Can we
really...
just go back to the funnel just for a second?
I just want to see if it stays in.
How do you think that works?
I don't. This is my minty moment where I say something really embarrassing every month, which has been happening.
So if you're a girl, take your funnel and your bottle with you.
That's what I'm saying.
On the go anywhere. So sorry, Emma.
No, that's fine. It's for people, basically, who do have bladder control, but who need assistance to transfer from chair to loo. And as one disabled man told me during the week, I'm not going to transfer for that. Because obviously...
Can't be bothered. Guys don't need to.
Yeah. So they're still going into the bathroom and they've still got a PA helping, but it's going into a bottle, not through the whole transferring thing. So it's very sensible, really. And one of the guys I talked to, Rob... He's got a Facebook group called Access Advisor, which, if you want to look at it, he's been telling me to push that all week. He leaves one in the toilets at work, leaves his bottle there, so everybody knows it's there. And actually, it's the difference between him needing PAs all day, every day, and instead someone pops in a couple of times a day to give him a hand to go to the loo, and he just does the bottle and off he goes.
So Emma, two more. Give us your best two. No, what's the next one?
Please, someone get this right, not Katie.
Me again.
Okay, so Elizabeth knows this one, so she's... not in this one, because she was the one who came up with it. Cold tea bags.
Puffy eyes.
No.
It's too obvious.
Heather, what do you think?
So do you mean, like, used tea bags that are cold? Is that what you mean?
I guess they can be used or unused, but as long as they're cold and have, yes, a wet, like, yeah, wet tea bags.
I don't know. As Simon said, I would have thought for puffy eyes, but that's too obvious.
Laura, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I would have said the same. And dry bags.
Can you give us a clue to the impairment type?
Well, Emma? I'm going to throw to Elizabeth on this one because she's the one who came up with it.
This one was actually recommended by a consultant and it was a new one on me, but cold tea bags can actually be really helpful for people who have nerve pain, no matter where that is. And so a lot of people carry them around in their handbag and apply them to the affected area to get pain relief. And it's actually the tannin in the tea bags that is kind of the active ingredient. So it's a little bit strange, but probably a lot better than having to take like prescription medications and actually often more effective.
I wouldn't put it in the funnel, though. Don't do that.
Where do you put
them? Do you put them on the bit that hurts?
Yes.
But under your clothes?
So, you've got to have a sort of watertight container to keep them in. So it does look a little bit odd, I guess.
A watertight container to keep... to carry them in. Okay.
But I say my knees are playing up. Do I take my trousers off and then just put them on?
Make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, pop the tea bag out the cup onto your knee.
It has to be cold, though.
I wouldn't advise doing it when they're hot, but
Then you've got the combination of the tannin and the heat. It's always good to have a bit of heat on a sore joint.
Kate's going for a bonus point. But I'm still, but I don't know, it sounds a little, I mean, if it's your wrist, fine, but if it's another part of your body, I'm just kind of, you're going to get it all over your clothes.
Okay. Quickly, Emma, what's the next part? Because Damon's shouting in my ear that Challenge Annika is almost finished.
Okay. Well, the last one is more of a test to see if you listened to our last podcast. Did you? to the last short podcast?
We only present it. We don't listen.
Definitely did. But my memory's so bad. Okay, Kate. That maybe
pen and
I'll
paper.
Forget.
Pen and paper.
Pen and paper. Okay, got a pen and paper. Yep. Oh, pen and paper. What do we take
carry
it
around with them.
Carry around pen and paper. I mean, there's so many reasons for that. I think Simon carries it for when he's bored. He does doodles.
Yeah, stress people. People do it as a sort of absent-minded stress thing.
Heather?
I actually carry pen and paper for documenting if I have triggers for anxiety.
And
that's what I do.
Nice. You see, there are multiple uses for these things. Deaf I think people. If we stayed here and talked about this for a while, we could figure out a reason why any disabled person would carry.
You've got to fill some time, but not
deaf
that much.
Deaf people.
Yeah, that's a sensible one.
Laura, what do you carry around a pen and paper with you?
Yeah, I do. I'm constantly doodling or writing notes to people. So, yeah, I always have pen and paper.
I would say it's something to do with writing down your medication or writing down, you know, your condition so people know it.
Well, no. So nobody listened to last week's podcast.
Damn it.
Because we had Helen Purvis on, who has non-convulsive epilepsy. And she carries a pen and paper with her so that when she has a seizure, her colleagues sit her down at a table, give her a pen and her paper, and scribbling and just watching the ink coming from the pen to the paper sort of helps her get through her seizure. And otherwise she'd be wandering around confused, you know, talking no sense, whereas this sort of focuses her and helps her through the seizure.
Just for clarity now, I realise you're talking about the little, not the big monthly podcast we do, you're talking about the little ones in between.
Yes, I'm talking about the short podcast.
The ouchlets, no.
I like that
ouch,
one.
Ouch, mini, yeah, one. Ouch, yeah. Things.
I told you I don't feel very well, but you feel like, you're coming across like you're really spaced out today, it's brilliant. Do you know we're on the quiz, though? I'm not going to take that away from you.
I got two on the quiz. I think that means that I'm the winner.
Thank you, Emma. I like this. It's going to be a big thing. You're going to explore this further.
We will have a feature on the website, yes. So if anybody else has something unusual that they keep handy for disability reasons, please let us know on Facebook, on Twitter at BBC Ouch. What's the email again?
ouch@bbc.co.uk.
That's the one. Yep.
So, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Always a joy to speak to you.
You're welcome. Thank you, everyone, for having me on again.
Thank you. Heather, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Now, you are our social media correspondent for the week.
Yes, apparently so.
Has there been much disability news going on in the social media land?
Yeah, well, I'm very interested in disability news all over social media, so I follow lots of different accounts that discuss it. But there's been several things I've kind of picked up on, really, particularly things that have gone viral.
Nice.
Yeah, so there's a couple of hashtags that are quite interesting to discuss.
Okay, so what's first on your list?
Okay, so first, as you know, in October it was World Mental Health Day, but there's been a resurgence of the hashtag trigger warning, or TW tag. And the reason for this is quite strange, actually. I mean, you see it floating around social media anyway.
So what is a trigger warning tag?
A trigger is something that might set someone into relapse if they have a difficulty with their mental health. Mm-hmm. Or if they're having a bad day, it alerts people that, you know, this item might have violence in it, or it might have talk of food if someone struggles with eating disorders. So it gives you a warning to kind of take care, look after your mental health, and know that there is something that is potentially upsetting or distressing in the content. There's been a discussion around this because it's quite a relevant topic at the minute with regards to what's shown on TV and whether or not trigger warnings are useful.
I mean, is there something to do with Coronation Street?
Yes, it is. So I don't know if anyone's a regular watcher of Coronation Street. I'm not personally, but I've kind of seen it floating around a little bit. Mm. And there's been quite a big controversial story. And I know soaps do discuss quite sensitive things, and they all seem a bit ridiculous, don't they?
But the most... Yes, there's a lot that goes on in one street, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. They always seem to be having the worst luck, don't they?
But what's the specific one recently?
So David Platt is a long-running character. He's been on the street for ages, apparently. And what's happened is there's been a really big issue with his wife being murdered. And as a result of this, he's kind of spiralled into depression. He's really struggling with bereavement. And he knows who's killed his wife. So what he tries to do is murder this murderer. So the issue is, you know, double-edged sword, really. You've got a murder, which is very violent. We've also got the issue of suicide. And the reason people have been talking about this a lot is there was no kind of warning that this is going to happen. It's potentially triggering for someone if they've had to deal with their own thoughts of suicide.
You mentioned this a minute ago, Heather, in the sort of value. And I know occasionally at the beginning of a show we will do it. I have other seen contrary points of view, which is kind of... You can't cover every single trigger, presumably. Yeah. I mean, everybody's got something, so where's the balance?
Heather just said earlier that food is a trigger for some people, and if you had to do a warning every time you showed food on TV,
Great Bruce Wakeoff.
There'd be a lot of problems. Do we think trigger warnings are helpful? Are they unhelpful? What's the level that they should come in?
If you'd have asked me this a few years ago, I might have said they were a bit unnecessary and that it's a bit silly to kind of trigger warning everything. Because like you say, with like MasterChef, you know you're going to be watching food. But there's certain things I think do need to be discussed a little bit more. Maybe suicide is one of them. It affects quite a lot of people, but it's one of those things people don't really talk about. And there isn't always the opportunity to discuss suicide and the feelings that surround it. And having like my own experiences with mental health and things like that, that would be something that would be potentially triggering for me. And it would be quite useful to, you know, have a warning of that.
Is there the helpline at the end of the show?
I mean, that is useful. But if you think about it, you know, when some shows start and they'll kind of warn you about nudity or strong language, you know, and that's a very quick thing to do, isn't it? But having a helpline at the end is useful, but it's not useful if you've had a complete relapse because of the content that's kind of, you know, coming before.
Emma, what were you going to say?
I've seen instances where people have said that the words trigger warning or the letters TW are triggering in themselves.
Exactly, yeah.
Blimey.
So it kind of gets you on edge, doesn't it? It gets me on edge when I see those words or those letters. So we don't tend to say the words trigger warning at the beginning of the podcast. We just use our language to say why some people might not want to listen further. Heather, is it more useful to maybe say just use everyday language rather than that those words?
No, I agree with you entirely.
Moving on, Heather, there was another hashtag, I'm not a junkie. Do we need the drugs that are prescribed?
Yes, this has been going on for a long time, but again, this is another thing that re-emerged on Twitter. There was a programme called The Doctor Who Gave Up Drugs, and it caused a really big fuss over social media. And I mean, as a person who, I take medication for my mental health conditions and painkillers for my physical disabilities, there's kind of this narrative around medication shaming, I guess. And particularly with mental health, I think a lot of people assume that medication is like the easy way out, that it's something that's kind of going to cure you of your symptoms.
Is this what was implied in the programme? What was the programme saying?
So the programme followed Dr. Chris Tulliken, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
It was on BBC One in the last few weeks.
It was.
So I think you'll...
Basically what he did is he got into a GP's surgery and he aimed to reduce the amounts of prescription medication that doctors were issuing their patients, whether that be antibiotics, which, you know, is a slightly different matter, or antidepressants and painkillers, and he wanted to kind of reduce everyone's intake of these things. But I thought really his reporting of it was quite clumsy. It wasn't, it just didn't seem to kind of fit, and it, I think...
So was he saying we shouldn't all be on all the tablets that we're on?
Well, isn't there also quite a lot of research, by the way, I take painkillers, but there's a lot of research that when you take groups, you can do blind studies, and placebos will have a good effect as well, so...
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think... My main issue with it is, because I understand painkillers, because, you know, I'm prescribed quite a lot of them, and I know they're addictive, and I know you've got to be very careful. But I think my main issue, and a lot of people's main issue on Twitter, was the antidepressants, that kind of medication, where a lot of people, you know, we don't talk about mental health as much as we should. And it was just perpetuating this medication shaming thing. And, you know, when I started taking medication myself, I didn't think it was the easy way out. I knew it wouldn't be.
What do you mean by the shaming bit? Are you saying that you should be embarrassed if you're taking medication? That's what they're implying?
That's kind of what this... Not embarrassed, I guess, but almost, you know... I think there's this narrative around if you take medication, you're kind of giving up.
Right.
If that makes sense. I know it's been said to me with painkillers as well. You know, you're kind of giving in to the pain or you're giving in to... you know, blimey. Your symptoms.
Why don't you try mindfulness?
Yeah, exactly.
All the time.
If they're taking it another way by saying there's too many antibiotics being prescribed, that means we're not having our own resistance, or so many people are having antidepressants now rather than alternative therapies. Mm-hmm. All of that I could imagine. But the idea, my surgeons or doctors will say, take it before you get the pain. It's not meant to be when you get the pain.
Yeah.
Let's make a barrier for the pain. That's the thing, isn't it? God, it's a tough one. I know my mum watched it and she's on all manner of tablets and she was like, I'm going to give them all up then. I think I should be... And we all just were like, you are crackers. Do not do that.
And they give them to me.
Or just hand them over. Yeah.
Nice. And the last one, Heather, which is no names in the US, a young boy with Down syndrome.
Oh, yeah. So this was... he's called Asher Nash. And what happened is, you might have seen this on Facebook in particular, it went really viral over there. And he has Down syndrome, and his mother, Megan, sent in some pictures to a casting agency, and he was rejected on the grounds that the client didn't specify they wanted anyone with special needs.
Was it modelling, just to be pedantic?
Yeah, modelling.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, and rightly so, I guess, she was outraged because they also didn't say, you know, we do want anyone with special needs. And she kind of thought, why does this have to be specified in the first place? Mm. So this was picked up by a group called Changing the Face of Beauty, and it was kind of discussed on there. And there's been some really interesting responses to that.
Like what? What kind of responses have people been
doing? I don't know whether I'm just really cynical. I'm in two minds about it. I mean, it's really useful, obviously, to kind of discuss representation. But I think the way people maybe go about it isn't necessarily helpful. There's been a lot of, you know, you call it inspiration porn, don't you, where, you know, disabled people are kind of treated in that manner. And I feel like it could be such a force for good, but so many people are kind of taking it completely the wrong way and skewing everything. And that's where it just doesn't sit right with me, really. I find it very uncomfortable.
Go back one step. What's your problem with inspiration porn? How would you describe inspirational porn?
So inspiration porn is, you know, the idea that disabled people are an inspiration to able-bodied people, or, you know, the fact that someone with a disability might have achieved something, so I can achieve something else as well.
So it's the Facebook memes that, so, you know...
Memes.
How do you pronounce it? Memes. Memes.
Memes,
oh,
yeah.
Age. That kind of go, look at this person, despite everything they've done that, and despite this they've done that.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and they're pretty mundane.
You know, yeah, and there's also the idea that, you know, the only disability in life is a bad attitude.
Oh,
that's one that's, like, pushed around a lot. And I don't know, I just find
that... I say that to Kate quite a lot.
And, Heather, is it the fact that people are so outraged that this little guy didn't get a modelling deal and because he's disabled? Is it the level of outrage that doesn't sit right with you? Because it was hugely shared, wasn't it? And
I don't think he didn't get the modelling job. I think he didn't even get invited to the casting.
Yeah, he didn't get a casting, that's the thing.
So what is it that doesn't sit with you? Is it the level of outrage? Is it how viral it's gone?
It's not the outrage. It's nothing to do with that. It's just the way it's kind of been... You know, because disabled people are always trying to fight for to be included, and for everything to be inclusive. But I feel like reacting to something like this is further segregating the disabled community, because it's further kind of, you know, creating a big difference. And I don't know really where the line is, to be honest. Because obviously we have to talk about these things, but I just feel like the response to this photo with all the inspirational comments, I just don't think it's useful. As a disabled person myself, I don't like being talked about in that way. I am a person. Yes, I'm disabled, but it's not the only aspect of my life. I think that's what makes me so uncomfortable about it, really, is I feel it is further segregating
the
disabled community.
Would the reaction have been different and more aggressive, say, if the child had been someone of colour and they'd been rejected, saying they didn't specify someone of colour? Would people be just outraged and said, this is out of order, without all the other inspirational bit?
Yeah, I think so. And this is where, you know, we've got a long way to go, haven't we, with disabled people's rights. We're getting there, but we're missing the mark in so many areas. And like you say, with, you know, with people of colour, there would be an outrage, but I don't think people would bring up the whole inspiration aspect.
And there's so many things about disabled kids and modelling. Why do all parents want to get their disabled kids into modelling?
Yeah, I know.
That's what it feels like, especially kids with Down syndrome. They're always pushing them to get in catalogues, and it's great, and I want to see them in there, but they can do other stuff.
Is there something deeper, do you think? Is it they want the world to appreciate they're beautiful, not just them as parents?
I don't even know what it is. I just think it's the way, like, people's reaction to it. And, you know, as I've said, we do need to do this. We need to make sure disabled people are represented. But we're further segregating the disabled community by reacting in this way.
Mm. That's really interesting that she's outraged by the outrage. It's good. I like that.
I like it, yeah.
I think that's about all we have time for, you know, Simon.
I think it is, but it's great, though.
Yeah, really
good. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emma.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
That's it for this month's talk show. We will be back in December with a special international edition that we're really looking forward to.
Oh, tell me more.
I can't say much about it at the moment, but it's looking really interesting.
Oh, exciting. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks to the production team, Beth Rose, Emma Tracy, and studio manager Guy Worth. The producer was Damon Rose. We don't have a track to play you out with today.
Do you want to sing?
I could give you a song right at the end, yeah.
Nice.
I'll get it ready. And while I do so, recommend us to your friends. Share us on Facebook.
Like us,
tweet us, rate us on, you know, the iTunes and other places to get your podcasts. Review us. Tell us how great we are. And remember, the more you rate and review us, the more other people get to find out about the joy that is the Ouch podcast. And with that, we'll see you in December. Bye.
Bye.